Hello and a big warm welcome back to the 100th episode of the Rugby Paper Podcast. Today we celebrate our century by previewing round four of the Guinness Six Nations with former Ireland centre and Ulster defence coach Johnny Bell before taking a brief trip down memory lane and looking back over the past 100 episodes. There we go. Sorry, my fault.
Oh, very professional.
Oh, God. All right. Well, it's the first time that's happened in 100 episodes, Chris. You know, I've had nightmares about me forgetting to press the recording button and then getting to the end of an hour and then looking back with a special guest and going, can you do that again, please? Nearly happened just then, but it didn't. A very warm welcome back to the Rugby Paper Podcast. Guys, this is the 100th episode. I hadn't told you that in advance. I only clocked it about a week ago. But yeah, we're now 100 episodes.
I'm raising my bat.
Yeah, exactly. Taking off the helmet, all of that jazz. So it's a special day for the Rugby Paper Podcast, actually. At the very end of the episode, the four regulars, we won't make Johnny Bell, who's the special guest today, hang around for that. We'll have a little bit of a chat to sort of reflect on the last 2 years. But obviously, Six Nations is the priority. And we do have Ulster defence coach and former Ireland centre Johnny Bell with us to discuss that England-Ireland game. How are you, Johnny?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm delighted to be part of the show. It's your... How many cats have you got so far? Is that, did you say that's your 100th?
100th, yeah. Yeah,
today's the day. I'm my first. First on the rugby pod, so yeah, looking forward to it.
I don't think all of us have been at every... I missed two, so I think I've got 98 caps. So I'll bring up my personal 100th in a couple, and I'm sure the other guys have missed their fair few as well, but collective 100th, certainly.
It's more Jeff Boycott than Viv Richards.
Certainly your end, Chewy. look, Johnny, we'll talk a little bit about Ulster, first of all. Obviously, it's been quite a big week, or 10 days, for you guys with Dan McFarlane leaving. You started that in the perfect way at the weekend, or the post-Dan McFarlane era, with that great win. So just talk about the importance of that with the next steps forward.
Yeah, look, obviously it's been a challenging few weeks, and it's I suppose people would say it's part of the job, but it's not the nice part of the job when somebody has to move on and lose their position. So we all take responsibility and accountability for that. Obviously, the man at the top, he's the one that moves on. But yeah, it was important for all of us as coaches and players to really make sure that we stepped out this weekend and fronted up. And, you know, we needed to show our fans that... you know, that we were ready to hit the rest of the season running and not just sort of stuttering over the finish line. So we've made a real sort of commitment to ourselves that we really want to hit the ground running. Now, that's not going to be easy because we've got some very tough games coming up, but we certainly want to go about it in the right way.
Obviously, that win was very timely and very important, but you've also got a nice three-week break now to sort of reset, maybe take stock of where you're at and look forward to, like you say, that end of season stretch. And you've got a difficult start to that with two games in South Africa. But how important is that 3 weeks to, one, obviously enjoy the Six Nations a little bit, obviously, but two, yeah, take stock of where you're at and make a plan of action for how you're going to finish the season right?
Yeah, well, it obviously gives us a chance to, as you say, take stock, have a look at things, take a bit of time off and sort of take a breather. But I think, you know, Richie Murphy's going to come in as the interim head coach post the Under-26 Nations. So we as coaches next week when we come back in, we need to make sure that we are preparing ourselves well for what is going to be a tough visit to South Africa and understanding what sort of squad we want to take and how we want to play the game out there. And obviously Richie, when he comes off that Six Nations duty, we'll have a big part in that. So, yeah, nice opportunity to take a bit of time off, take stock, and watch the Six Nations. And I think we could all say we're sort of fully involved and immersed in that at the moment. It's been great.
Johnny, one of the themes that have developed over this podcast, when we've spoken to guys from Ulster or associated with Ulster, Willie Anderson was one, Stephen Ferris was another. Both of them expressed not alarm, but a slight discomfort at the sort of what's almost the sort of Leinster monopoly on sort of Irish rugby in terms of high achievement and a concentration of Dublin-based players in the national side. Do you guys in the current Ulster setup sort of share any of that discomfort? Do you think that things are slightly lopsided and therefore can't really continue in that way, or do you take heart from some of your performances and a bit of a Munster resurgence of late? I don't know what side of that line you'd fall on.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's pretty obvious. Leinster are incredibly strong, and they provide a very high percentage of the national team, and have done for quite a few years. Obviously, there was a time when Munster and Leinster collectively probably provided the majority, with obviously a certain number from Connacht and a certain number from Ulster. So it's not something. It is something obviously we're aware of, and it's something that we strive within the other provinces. I'm sure Munster, Connacht, and Ulster would be in the same thought process here, that we need to develop our own. We can't look at the Leinster model and just be envious the whole time. We've got to try and work out how we're going to do things, and it might have to be that we do it differently because our situation, our circumstances aren't the same. As you say, Leinster have a very strong contingent of private schools in that Greater Dublin area that provide a high proportion of players into that academy, not exclusively, because a lot of club players are starting to come through, but a high percentage of those players are from the likes of St Michael's, from Blackrock. I think in the Leinster game a couple of weeks ago, I think there were out of the 23, there were 12 St Michael's players in that squad.
Really?
So that shows you the sort of the power base around that Greater Dublin area. And yeah, look, particularly in Ulster, we know we've got a sort of much that wider geographical situation. And we, number one, we don't have private schools as such. We have grammar schools, very good grammar schools that have traditionally fed into the system. And the club game, we're trying to really cast the net wider to pull in a lot of club players. So it is something that we are, with the powers that be, are addressing from the pathway system right through into the academy, and we're looking at how we can best, I suppose, make sure that we have the most efficient system that fits for Ulster. I don't know if that
Absolutely.
answers the question. That's probably, I'm not trying to
No,
bluff it. It's just that's.
absolutely. It seems, as you say, it's a statement of fact. Those schools that you referred to around the Dublin area, it was either Willie or Stephen, probably Stephen said, well, their sort of strength and conditioning kind of approach is virtually professional. It's almost of a standard of full-time professional S&C work. Well, that's a massive thing for people who are in that environment. I mean, it gives them a hell of a lift, I would think.
Absolutely, but I mean, it's, people say, obviously tend to say, well, if you throw money at things that improve, it's not that they don't, but there
Oh
is
no, we've tried that in
significant
England.
there is but there is significant investment in that program, out with Leinster, because the schools, as I say, are private. They're privately funded. They generate their own income to put a budget together that funds, as you talk about, that F&C program right the way through. My son is he's at Campbell College Junior School this year, and he's excited. They're going down this weekend to play Blackrocks Junior School, which is Willow Park. And it'll be really interesting from my perspective just to see even at that young level. And these are 11-year-olds, how skillful they are, and how we compare at that level to that kind of team. So yeah, it's the nature of it, and the funding is strong there. The system works very, very well for Leinster. Really strong school system. But likewise, in Ulster, there is, and traditionally and historically, have been a very good school system who produced a lot of players. It's because you're in the same island as a club like Leinster, you're continually compared, and you try and try and pitch yourself up against that. So it's our job to make sure that we are getting the best fit for Ulster.
I mean, when I covered Ireland, Johnny, for about 15 years, I always felt that a Connacht player and an Ulster player had to work harder to get favour with the national selectors. From a very objective viewpoint, I'd watch players who I think, from Ulster and Connacht were absolutely on a level with Munster and Leinster, but weren't getting picked or weren't getting the start. But then again, so I thought that must be an Irish thing. But then you come back to England and, winning breeds success. If you're in the Saracens team, if you're in the Leicester team, you automatically get looked at a bit different. It's always been the case. So actually, I don't think it's particularly an Irish thing at all. It's just the way, but because of the very, you know, insular, compact nature of Irish rugby, it just shows up a bit more.
Yeah, look, I don't believe that. Actually, what I believe is that it's an easy thing for a disgruntled player to say, you know, from Ulster or Connacht. But I think, look, if you look in the past, the strong Munster sides, obviously the Leinster sides, the combinations, and that's part of, I mean, we'll probably come to it a little bit later, the cohesion within those sides that then transfers into the international stage. International coaches don't get a huge amount of time with the players. So it's important that they have cohesion there. And those teams that are winning things regularly, then tend to have, if you look at the old argument where it was O'Gara and Stringer and David Humphreys was up in Ulster. And at the time, I think Declan Kidney wanted that combination of O'Gara and Stringer because they were playing together consistently. Yeah. Not that necessarily O'Gara or Humphreys, who was the better player. You could argue that until the cows come home. But I think that as a coach, he felt that that combination and that winning combination, they were used to playing with each other. And I think that that is relevant to this day. I think winning teams, winning combinations, it's much more cohesive and it transfers, I suppose, much much easier into the national setup.
Are the schools managing to, in Ulster, managing to keep up playing numbers? Are playing numbers falling off the edge of a cliff as they have done in England, or is it fairly constant still?
Well, I couldn't give you the exact numbers, but it certainly is a challenge. I think it's a challenge across the board, and that's something that, as I say, the powers that be are trying to make sure that we make rugby safe, that we make it a sport that parents feel they can trust the pathway and trust the school, so it's that they have the best interests of their son or daughter at heart. But yeah, certainly it's a challenging time, I think, across the board in rugby and keeping playing numbers for a lot of different reasons.
We touched on strength and conditioning. It's always bothered me a bit, you know, that some kids will be pushed into strength and conditioning programs too soon. You know, playing rugby is what they ought to be doing initially. What's the sort of where's the cutoff point where they start, trying to build bulk and so on and so forth, trying to develop muscle? Are you getting players coming through who are already there pretty well, at 18 or 19, or do you really have to, in order for them to be competitive at professional level, do you really have to work on them in their sort of initial 2 years or whatever?
It's improving a lot, I think. Schools vary in their sort of, I suppose, how they perceive that strength and conditioning and how much they invest. And I think most schools are starting across the board to put more and more emphasis on that. From an Ulster perspective, you're trying to get players through who are equipped and ready to step up and train, because their training loads will be much less. And then physically, if you put them in a position where they're exposed to that training load and they're not ready physically to deal with it, that can be a real issue. So that is an ongoing improvement, and our academy do a good job of bringing these players out of school and then trying to make sure whilst they're getting, and I believe it's important they're getting rugby first and foremost, that they are physically developing, because those years, you know, from 16, 18, 20, those are really developmental years in their physical growth. So it is challenging. There's no doubt about it. I don't believe this is my personal opinion, that it's just about stick them in the gym when they're really young and all of a sudden they'll become brilliant rugby players when they come out. I believe it's about them being able to play rugby, them understanding the game, having the skill set to be able to deal with it. But I'm not naive to know that the game needs strong physical men. That is the modern rugby athlete at the moment, that they're strong, fast and physical. So they have to be prepared to then come into a training environment that they can cope with, as opposed to they can't cope with it, they break down, and then they're missing rugby and that development over a year or two because they're breaking down every time they take a pitch.
Yeah. Do you think that's sustainable, John? I mean, you get given that nothing stands still, strength and conditioning, sports science, everything that surrounds it has made massive strides, huge strides in the professional era, let's say. So if it's going to keep on improving, that means greater pace, greater dynamism, or a combination of the two, stronger players, an increase in physicality. There are people out there who are saying, look, there's only so much a human body can stand here. And that's on a road to, if not ruin, it's on a road to trouble. And we've already seen it, obviously, with the class action around concussion. Or is there an argument that says that somehow, through something as extreme as weight limits or something, you depower this thing? You can't make individuals be worse than they are. That's fantasy land. But you could take some quite radical steps if you wanted to, for want of a better word, depower the game. Is there anything in that argument, or do we just carry on?
It's a difficult one. I think the game's going to continue to evolve. I don't see players getting slower and smaller.
Some of us managed it.
I realised that was happening whenever I decided to retire for me. When Trimble and Bow and Ferris, these guys were coming through, I realised, yes, I'm going in the wrong direction here. Slower, fatter, weaker. It was the right thing to do. But yeah, look, what I feel here is I think, and I'm not just going to sit and forget about the Irish system, I think they do manage it very well. You look at the likes of Dan Sheehan, the big, fast, physical, but has a great understanding of the game, great skill set. You look at a lot of those Irish forwards, they're probably, I'd say, as powerful and physical as we've had in an Irish system for quite a while, but their skill sets are so good at the moment. They make the highest number of passes of any Six Nations team. So it's combining that physical development alongside that skill set. And I think the Irish system do it very well and manage that very well. For young kids, yeah, look, I'm a real advocate of them understanding the skill side of the game, understanding the game fundamentally, understanding, you know, as a 10, what it takes to play the game, and not being obsessed with just the physical side of it. That has to be carefully managed alone. But it's making sure that there's a really, I suppose, connected program from a young age through, that doesn't put them in the wrong place when it comes to that important time.
Shall we just do? Have you seen that there's now an enhanced Olympics? Shall we have an enhanced rugby? see what we would make of that? Because Sebco is furious at the enhanced Olympics. Anyway.
Is that chemically enhanced?
Yes.
Is that what you're referring to? Oh, well, South Africa win that hands down. There's no point. Give them the medal now. That's not too controversial, is it?
Well done, Chris. You just got the comments section.
Before we move on from that, Ollie, one thing that could instantly help on that, and we have discussed it before, is just cut out this sort of 8 or 9 raft of replacements that come on. If you just reduce the replacements to the sort of legally required, which, I mean, you have to have front row replacements, I get that, and maybe one more, you're going to depower the game a bit because the guys are going to have to run for 80 minutes, not 45, a lot of them. So that's one simple thing you can do.
Guys, I'm just going to nudge the conversation gently in the direction of the Six Nations, because we've only got Johnny for an hour and we're 25 minutes in and haven't even mentioned England Ireland yet. So I think we should probably do that. Obviously, this Saturday is a big game by all accounts, but I think it's fascinating to me when you think about Ireland's post-World Cup trajectory and you going into Rugby World Cup 2023, a lot of people had France and Ireland as the two favourites. I know I would have annoyed some South African fans in the comments section again, but they were already in a bad mood because of Chris's comments about the enhanced rugby. Anyway, their post-World Cup trajectory has obviously been chalk and cheese. And just from your point of view, Johnny, I wanted to know if you were worried about exactly what's happened with France, happening with Ireland, a post-World Cup hangover or post-World Cup fatigue.
No, personally, I wasn't. I thought, obviously, everyone, I suppose the media create this circus around, when things don't go as planned, then it's like everything's going to fall apart. And I think Ireland were very, very close to beating New Zealand in that, and Jan Sheehan over the line. So coming off the back of that, obviously Sexton was retiring, but the majority of the team, there was still a strong core of that leadership there. There was, Jack Crowley was coming through. I didn't feel that there was going to be a real drop off. I wasn't sure, obviously, necessarily. I didn't think they were going to beat France the way they did at the start of the Six Nations, but I certainly was confident that they were going to progress and grow. I think Andy Farrell has been steadily building this group and evolving the game. And this comes back to, again, what I sort of alluded to earlier, the cohesion across the provinces, style of play. There's the way Leinster play, the way Ulster maybe are trying to play, the way Connacht are playing, and particularly in their attacking shapes, are it's very connected, and that transfers up to the national side. So there's not a huge amount of difference, and players can fit in pretty seamlessly to that. Similarly, in defence, obviously, Jack has come into Leinster, and he's going to change the way Leinster defends. So it'll be interesting to see from a national's perspective, does Simon evolve that a little bit and try and bring in the aspects of that type of D. But no, I didn't feel that there was going to be a real drop off in performance. I as I say, I didn't know they were going to really crack on as well as they've actually done. I just think they look really comfortable at the moment in their own skin and look, head and shoulders amongst, ahead of other sides, to be honest, in the Six
And
Nations.
are you surprised by the way that France have imploded? Because certainly the people on the rest of this panel are, because we all voted them as Six Nations champions this season, I think. So yeah, what are your thoughts on France?
Yeah, I suppose that's the bigger shock to me, is just how France have kind of they've lost a little bit of their shape and their confidence and their joie de vivre, for want of a better way of putting it. I thought, defensively, France have always been incredibly strong under Sean Edwards, and they still are very good defensively. But like you saw against Ireland, they had a bad day at the office, and then in attack, they just look. I mean, we can talk about Tupont, we can talk about and Ntamack and guys like Roman and Ntamack and stuff. But has one or two players really derailed the whole system of the French national team? And it just seems at the moment they look a little bit rudderless from that perspective. They just don't really understand what they're trying to do, and there just seems to be a real lack of confidence. But they have the ability, French are French, and they have the ability to turn it on in any given day. But yeah, that would be the bigger shock for me, is just how France have maybe fallen away. And maybe that is an emotional, more of an emotional drop off from the World Cup, a home World Cup, so much intensity and pressure and expectation to do well and to win at home. And maybe the players have maybe struggled to reach the same emotional height or heights that they did during a World Cup.
Given you don't seem to have
Sorry.
that togetherness, do they? I mean, what's going on behind the scenes there? Who can tell? But Galtier is under a lot of heat now. I mean, he's getting quite a lot of public criticism from other big name coaches. And when he was a player, he could divide the crowd a bit, Galtier. And maybe it's some people getting their own back from past wrongs. But he does seem to. Whereas Farrell does seem to have almost tightened that whole Irish spirit. Look, this is a massive disappointment we've just been through. We threw everything at that, but most of us are going to be around for another 4 years. We have to go again. And he just seems to be very, very good at pulling people together in adversity and squeezing another level out of them. Whereas on the face of it, Galtier, although he's lost his best player, obviously, best couple now, he doesn't seem to have been able to do that.
Yeah, look, I generally would wax lyrical about Andy Farrell. I knew him when he was at Saracens. I have close connections with Mark McCall at Saracens, and I knew him from briefly from that experience when I was visiting. And he was first and foremost, an unbelievably good person. And then coming back from England into the national system, part of the Irish system here, just the boys can't speak highly enough of the environment that he creates, of the ability coming from the Joe Smith era, an unbelievably good coach, unbelievably detailed, unbelievably strict in, and put the fear of God in certain players about knowing their detail and getting it right. And Andy has had that ability, and this is a really, really special ability, to be able to maintain those high standards that Joe set, but also then putting or giving the players the opportunity to know when there's a chance to relax and switch off, and knowing when they have to switch on. And he's created a really strong environment around switching on and switching off. They changed their base, their training base, that, you know, so that they weren't continually training at the same and staying at the same hotel, if that makes sense. So they were able to, they were able to separate that. So right, we're going to training now. Right, we switch on. Now we're back to the hotel. It's time for you to relax. Go and spend time with your family. You know, do whatever it takes for you to relax and be yourself. And they talk a lot about being themselves, not trying to force themselves to be this certain type of professional. So I can only go. This is obviously all hearsay from me, but I all the players speak incredibly highly of him. And then being down in camp on a couple of occasions, just so relaxed, well run. The coaches are very, very comfortable in their own skin, very comfortable around the players. But again, that comes with time, doesn't it? That comes with getting a group of players, working with me, working with them obviously under Joe. And now he's continuing that on and doing it in his own way. The players are very, very comfortable. They understand what he expects from them. And you know, I think that leads to an environment where the players feel that they can go out and be themselves and express themselves. Easy to say when you're winning lots of games, I get that, but it's the consistency now that Ireland have, I feel. And we even talk, even after that World Cup disappointment, Ireland, you know, they still were playing well. It wasn't as though they just had an off day and were smashed by New Zealand. They could have won that game. Fair play to New Zealand. They did. They turned it on and did a job on the day. But I don't think it's the consistency that they have shown over a long, long period of time now that really impresses me.
He's a great learner, isn't he, Andy Farrell? You know, he came from league. He learnt Union right at the basics because he hadn't even played Union, unlike some like Sean Edwards. He learnt his trade at Saracens. He learnt as an apprentice coach at England. He had the massive disappointment of 2015 World Cup where basically they all got sacked and moved on. I mean, that would have been a blow to him. But he's kept on learning all the time. And you get the feeling, as you say, Johnny, really nice guy. And he's just bringing it all together. And this is his moment. He really is running a fantastic show there.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the ability technically to be able to Irish players, they will always challenge and ask, why are we doing things? Why are we doing this? Why are we defending this way? Why do you want us to attack in tight shapes? That's in the Irish nature. They're quite savvy around the rugby. And Andy has this ability to be able to bring everyone together and pull everyone in the same direction. I think, and again, I believe fundamentally that he is a player that the players. What's the best way to describe it? That the players feel at ease with, and they feel that they can approach him, and they have respect for him. But they also know that he can come down hard if he needs to, and that balance is really important when dealing with professional athletes, knowing when to you know say it how it is, and when how to just give them a pat on the back. And I think he does a really fantastic job of that. And he's got good technical staff around. We talk, he's learnt the game, he's studied the game. A lot of the attack shapes that Cat is using and doing brilliantly. Andy has a strong influence there as well. And they're tight shapes that you would see in league. With a runner at the line, square, somebody tight coming on a down line with another player as options. So there's multiple options at the line, and they're all animated and all alive and all in sync. And that's what makes them so dangerous, because they have that ability and that threat across the board.
And looking at You know, looking at Saturday, Johnny, would you say that England, given their current state compared to Ireland's, have got a prayer?
Well, yes, I would, because that's the nature of rugby. I think, you know, on any given day, anything can happen. We know England are going to be emotionally in a good place. They're going to be up for it. They obviously will be disappointed after that Scotland game. That was a really disappointing performance. Do I see them beating Ireland? Personally, no. I think even with all the emotion that they're going to bring, Ireland have too much ability both sides of the ball. They're going to be able to. We're all talking about Ireland's attack at the moment. Their defence, they've only conceded 3 tries, of which one has been a penalty try. That they are very, very stingy at coughing up points for the opposition. Very disciplined. And yeah, I just don't see England as having enough firepower to really damage Ireland from that perspective. England are going to need to score tries because Ireland are going to score tries, I feel. So it's interesting just to see. I do know what I'm fascinated about. I'm really, really fascinated to see how Ireland deal with this aggressive blitz and press that Felix is bringing in. I know they'll have certain things in place, but I'm fascinated by that to see how Ireland try and unpick that because I think England will get some joy in that at the same time. But can they stop them getting over the whitewash? That's the thing.
I think England, I agree with all of that, Johnny. And I think England will certainly, I look back to last year's game in Dublin, where until the sending off, which was an odd old thing one way or another, but England were a pain in the arse that day for Ireland. They were very competitive at breakdown. They made the game quite a claustrophobic affair. They didn't give the Irish room to breathe or their attacking game the room to breathe. And while you couldn't see England outplaying them at any point during that game or outscoring them, you can sort of stay in touch with a mood and a collective aggression and a collective desire, which is not always a stamp of the England side, but it tends to be an adversity. So I think they'll be better than people think in that respect on Saturday. I confidently expect Ireland to win the game because I think they're stronger in virtually every department and of a level where they're not stronger.
I couldn't agree with you more on that. I think it's going to be so much tighter than people think. I think England will really go aggressive at the breakdown. Ireland play off 2.5 second ruck speed, so they thrive. Gibson Park likes to get the ball on the move. They make the most passes. They make the most meters. So England are going to go right. How do we stop this source? So set piece. Can we get into them set piece? Breakdown, can we stop the flow of their game from a set from a multi-phase perspective? And I think they will kick a fair bit and try and pressure Ireland. I mean that is England's game at the minute. They're heavily focused on defence, and basically squeezing teams. I think they're Ireland's attacking 22 entries and are 32 or something, and England's are 30. It's the conversion rate that England needs to sort out, really. But I do think England will go to quite an attritional game and try and squeeze Ireland and try and frustrate them. If you look at the Wales game, it actually was Ireland's attack and multi-phase shape didn't, you know, it challenged Wales, but Wales dealt with it, I thought, pretty well. There was a lot of movement. And maybe you could say Andy was a bit frustrated, just was he wanted more intent in the carries and more intent at the breakdown. I think that was what they were disappointed, but I thought Wales dealt with that. So I really am fascinated. I think they're going to go hard at the breakdown and really challenge Ireland around there.
Yeah, just to add some, you're absolutely right in terms of the 22 entries. I think it's Ireland are top and England are second. It's something like 30 and 28. But England have the fewest points per entry in the entire championship with 1.8, while Ireland have the most in 3.4. So obviously that's the essence between the two teams. And just going back to what you were saying about it being tight, the last 8 games between England, Ireland, and the Six Nations have had winning margins of greater than 10. We've all predicted a winning margin of less than 10. Given obviously our predictions being so bad this year, that maybe is not necessarily a bearing on how it's actually going to go. And the fact we keep mentioning our prediction for a France Grand Slam is I don't know why we keep doing that, but we keep throwing ourselves under the bus. But does that sort of Johnny's stat about the 22 entries pretty much sum up where England and Ireland are so different at the moment. And also there's been rumoured this week about some unsettlement in England camp, because all England do in training sessions is work on the blitz defence when it's their attack that is so misfiring at the moment.
Yeah, look, I don't know the ins and outs of what's going on in camp. I think when a new coach comes in, particularly of Felix's experience, what he's trying to do with the side, it's a radical change in their system of defence. So they are going to spend a significant amount of time prepping for that to get it right. But I have no doubt there will be balance, that they will be looking at how their attacking shape and where they can hurt Ireland, and they'll be looking at all aspects of the game. But it's not sure that they are going to focus heavily on defence. And I would say that, I suppose, Steve's mindset as a coach, he's a type five forward. Not that the greatest respect, and he is coached at a much higher level than I have, but he's probably of a mindset, right, you know, I want to build a squad here that get the fundamentals right around set piece and around defence, and then we'll grow our attack as we go along the journey. But because Felix is coming in, he's got quite a big personality. He's gonna want to drive that side of things, and I think with a lot allied to Steve's mindset, there's going to be a fair amount of time spent on it.
I just wondered if you could unravel something a little bit or illuminate it a bit, Johnny. Is that Felix Jones, as I understand it, and I think Schalk Berger and Jean de Villiers were talking about this in a podcast, he was South Africa's attack coach. Now, England he's come into England and he's now England's defence coach. Do you think that, I mean, obviously he understands, you know, there's a symbiosis between the two, and obviously he understands the defensive game, I'm sure, pretty well. Are you surprised by that at all, that he's been employed as a defence coach rather than an attack coach? And how much does the attack coach, does it depend from team to team, bleed in, you know, the defence coach bleed into the attack?
Yeah, look, as you said right at the start, the game is so interdependent on all aspects of the game. You can't operate in isolation. You know, and as coaches, you lead on the certain areas, but you still have to have a collective input in other areas. Because as I say, if some attacks will be their mindset, well, we're gonna run a lot of ball. We want to play from deeper. And that's then, if you're making mistakes and you're not accurate with that, that's going to have an impact on defence. I think that from Felix's perspective, I think he started off as an attack coach. I think when Jack went to head coach, then he probably had a greater influence, and maybe Jack brought him across to do some and lead on the defence, whilst Jack oversaw the whole thing. Felix is a student of the game. He understands it inside out. He's got an incredible amount of IP coming out of South Africa now, and coming out of two successful World Cups. I don't think that he could be hindered by you're an attack coach or you're a defence coach. I think he's coming in now firmly as a lead on defence. He's going to bring what he feels he has learned from Jack, clearly, and from that South African environment, and he's going to try and drive that into the English system. And you can see it. You can see the energy that it brings. You can see how difficult it is to play against. But you can also see it can be picked off at times. But I would say the better the players get, the more they get used to it, and the better they get at it, I think you'll find that. That they're able to make sure that even those line breaks, they don't result in tries. At the minute they result in tries, they'll come to a point where they will scramble incredibly well and be able to solve those. Again, that's what the South African mindset is. Let's be positive in defence. Let's make things happen. And if they get outside us, we'll scramble.
I think I'm right in saying that when New Zealand had Graham Henry, Steve Hansen, and Wayne Smith, which was a considerable think tank, they swapped roles every 18 months or couple of seasons. So they all contributed in sort of pretty much each department. So that certainly bears out the idea that someone like Felix Jones is equally relevant in the end, in the final analysis, wherever you put him. If he's a good coach with that level of game understanding, then he's going to be relevant wherever he is.
Yeah, but what it raises is, I mean, the question at the moment that England face going into this game against Ireland is very, very clear. Their defence is a work in progress. Their attack is very much,
Work in regress.
well, it's certainly it's very inconsistent and very intermittent, and
But it's clarity, Nick, isn't it? I mean, what Ireland have, and we've been saying this for 18 months, whatever it is, Ireland seem to have great clarity, great understanding of what they're setting out to do, and their level of application born of that understanding is very, very high. It's up around New Zealand levels. I mean, as good as New Zealand at the moment. And England don't have that clarity. And it's possibly easier to have clarity in defence, even with a new system, than it is in attack, where almost by definition, unless you're playing off first phase, your plans aren't there in the same to the same extent as they would be in a defensive
Yeah,
system.
sure. But Steve Borthwick has now been in position as head coach for over a year. And apart from a game against South Africa in a semi-final in which it was a wet track and they played an extremely intense and accurate game of kick chase.
Which is what they'll do against Ireland on Saturday.
Yeah, quite possibly. But the thing about it is that if England are going to develop, they have to develop. And this is just, same old, same old. This is, stasis. For that to work, the only justification for it is if they win. That's it.
I want Borthwick in place until he tells a joke. And I'm completely immovable on the subject. You won't hear any criticism of Borthwick from me while he's yet to tell a joke. And that's it.
Chris, if I'd kept you on the podcast until you told the joke, you would have told a joke, you would have been gone within 2 minutes.
Indeed. Indeed. But
What I would say on that.
humour is in the ears of the beholder, which is a complete mixed metaphor and almost a hanging offence.
Not your first on the podcast.
I was going to say what I would say on the style of play. I do think, and it comes back to the Irish system, I think they've got four provinces. And yes, there will be slight differences. Munster don't play exactly the same as Leinster, but I'll be honest, being here, the systems of attack are very similar. They play tight shapes. They have forwards who make a lot of passes. They have multiple threats at the line. They're always very, very well connected. So you have a pod off nine, you have a connector out the back, you have another pod. And the timing and movement of those players is the detail that they work on consistently so that they're always animated, always in play. I think, and that would go to Connacht. Johnny Sexton's brother, Mark Sexton, is coaching Connacht's attack this year. And again, very, very similar style of attack that Connacht have evolved into this year with tight connected shapes.
Do the national coaches have an input in that at all? Or is that just happenstance?
I think probably not a direct influence, but we are there is a strong connection, and we'll go down to Irish camps, and there's a lot of professional development and sharing from that perspective, and the Irish coaches will be around the provinces and talking to various coaches and directors of rugby. So there is, and that's much easier because you've only got four provinces, and so there, that is quite strong. But I do believe that leads into the national system, and I think it's much easier then to have that continuity and have that very, very, I suppose, established style of play that Ireland have. And I've evolved into, and they'll tweak it and they'll grow it, and different players will step in, but they're not stepping in from a completely different system and going, right, what I have to do, this is going to take me a couple of weeks to, you don't have a couple of weeks, you need to do this now. So yeah, I think that has a big effect. And I think when you look at, I remember quite a while back, we were talking about Australian rugby, and they were saying the Australian teams of the 80s and the 90s, the majority of the players came from Queensland and New South Wales, maybe like a nearly a 50-50 split. And then some Brumbies came in, and it was maybe a few Brumbies, but still Queensland. And they were the best teams because they were so cohesive. And I'm sorry, probably overusing that word, but it does have an impact when you come into a national setup. It breeds confidence, it breeds familiarity around what you're doing under pressure. And you can see that very, very evidently from the Irish team, and probably a little bit more clunky in the English attack as they're trying to work out what exactly they're doing.
Do you think,
sorry, that was a bit long-winded.
No worries. Do you think from an Ireland perspective that there's still a bit of a Twickenham aura? Obviously, I think you've won your last four games against England. Only one of them has been at Twickenham, and that was when Charlie Yules was sent off in the 8th minute. And John Fogarty has already spoken about the fact that England still gave you some trouble, particularly at scrum time. And I think we were, you know, within touching distance until the 70th minute or something when we started to tire. But is there still a bit of a Twickenham aura, do you think? And do you think that's a contribution to why all of our predictions have been so tight?
I think there's a respect around going to Twickenham. I think in the last number, is it the last three games have been red cards? England have three red cards.
Yeah,
that's significant. You know what I mean? It's not. So I think Fogs is right. He's, you know, Ireland know they don't have a God given right to turn up and on Twickenham on the weekend and just win. But I do believe that. Certainly, from my day in the sort of 90s, was probably the worst time to play for Irish rugby. But you know, we didn't win at Twickenham, and there was a lack of confidence. I think coming out of back then, maybe Ulster weren't playing regularly in Europe, for instance. And whereas you were watching on TV, the Bath, the Leicesters, they were the dominant team. So there was a little bit of inferiority, whereas now I think there's a confidence that has grown out of the provinces that has then led into the national team. So I think there'll be a healthy respect, no doubt about it, but they won't feel.
Ireland's biggest problem at Twickenham will be the fact that Rag and Bone Man is playing at half time. So by definition, England can serve up any old crap and still win.
Chris, I'm this close to removing you from the call.
This is the man who made Willie John McBride laugh.
You're taking that to the grave. Guys, let's talk about England a little bit. Johnny, how long have you got till you need to go?
Don't you crack on.
Yeah. If you're happy, obviously, we'd love to keep having you if you're happy to stay on the call. I know I said an hour, but during Six Nations time, it does tend to run over slightly. We've already sort of alluded to it, and this is kind of an open question to the panel, but do we think the whole New England, you know, get Twickenham on its feet again, does that go out the window on Saturday in the way that, you know, against Argentina, they came with a set plan, they executed it. Against South Africa, they very much came with a set plan and executed it. Do you think it's just win at all costs and we go back to the air, back to the kick battle, Stewart comes back in at fullback, et cetera?
Well, it's the big litmus test, isn't it, for both. I enjoyed Nick's dream team, England team that he'd like to see play in his column this week. A fantastic, sort of exciting, all singing, all dancing lineup. I'd love to see that team play. It won't happen. I don't think it'll happen. I think he will go for the result. He'll go for the repeat in the South Africa semi-final performance. It's just not in his nature. Certainly in this match, it's not in his nature. But as Nick says, is it 19 matches a year in now? When is it going to happen? If you're going to get the change, the development, the try and the good players in new positions, when's it going to happen?
In New Zealand this summer, Brent.
Yeah, just the place.
That's a good one. New Zealand in Auckland's always a good match to try a few things, isn't it?
I mean, do we think there's any grounds for experimentation? Obviously, Marcus Smith is back from injury. He's in contention. We called for Emmanuel Faye-Wabosso to come straight in.
I think he'll start.
You think Smith will start as well, or do you think?
Probably not. He's such a Ford fan, and Smith hasn't played a lot of rugby. Well, he hasn't played since the last match of Europe, has he? He hasn't played in 2 months, so it'd be a big shout, that one. I think he'll probably start with Ford.
Yeah. No.
Do you think he'll stick with Ollie Lawrence?
I would, but I mean, he had the worst match of his career 2 weeks ago, but he's a good player. It's just he's a
Oh, he's a good
13,
player.
not a 12.
Brent, but also a bloke coming off, you know, again, a
5 weeks of no rugby.
5 week layoff, you know.
No, I'm a lot Ollie Lawrence fan. He's a 13 and he'll do a great, good job for England going forward. But, you know, do you back him? Yeah, you do back him because he's a good player.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I think the selection will be very tough in terms of.
Who will also be picked ahead of? Who will he come in for, do you think?
Daly. Elliot
Maybe he'll
Daly.
come in for the other.
Yeah, the king utility. I tell you what, Elliot Daly would have another 10 years. If we introduce that utility back on the bench, Elliot Daly would have another 10 years on
He'd have a good run at that, wouldn't
the bench. He'd be ecstatic. And what about, do we think George Martin, for example, comes in as well?
he? The one area where England don't have much of a problem is lock, I think, at the moment. Itoje's back up there now, and I think he'll be a big player. Well, he's always a big player, isn't he? But he'll be a big player for England on Saturday, along with Earl. In fact, as two disruptors of whatever Ireland are trying to do, the way they're playing at the moment, Itoje and Earl will be quite a bit to handle, I think, for Ireland. They will disrupt, and I think Chessam's a decent player. But you know, if you're going to pick Martin, I don't have a big problem with that. I mean, he's but he how much rugby has he played?
Not a lot. But again, I'm just thinking about the Springbok plan of action because was Martin. Did we pick three locks that day? I can't quite remember who was at six. But either way, Martin came in and obviously did a job on the Springboks pack, or certainly held his own against the Springboks. And I just wonder whether a similar sort of plan of
Well, they
action.
would have picked Laws at six, wouldn't they, that day?
That, there you go.
You had two and a half locks, that's for sure.
He came off the bench in that game, didn't he, Martin?
Did he know Martin started against South Africa?
They've been pretty consistent in their selection of the back five, haven't they, of the scrum over the Six Nations. I mean, as you said, that back row, I think that's a very good back row. I think Ben Earl's incredible. I think they're going to pick the tight five or a set piece tight five. They're a nutritional tight five. I think we'll stick to that if they're going to go to this aerial game and try and force pressure. It'll be interesting to see. Do they bring Mitchell back in at nine?
And I think they will. He has obviously not had a massive break from rugby like the other two that we mentioned have. It is a good back row. Chewy, the back row you called for in your column for the rugby paper.
I mean, I find the Zach Mercer thing really weird. I mean, really weird. I don't think anyone's near the truth of what's happened there at all. And now I'm reading that the French are after him again.
Well, he's playing for the Barbarians this summer now instead of England, isn't he? So he's obviously.
I mean, he's. I mean, to me, as I wrote on Sunday, to me, he's the best footballing number eight in the country by a mile, by a mile. And if you're the player of the top 14, you're no one's idea of a pacifist either. And I use the old Tony Diffrose example. Everyone thought Tony Diffrose was too soft. Well, he got kicked from household at breakfast time in New Zealand in 1998 when all the tough boys went missing. So that told you how soft Tony was. I there must have been a falling out. I mean, look, I'm happily appear in court and be charged with slander if there hasn't been a falling out between Borthwick and Mercer, but I do not see any other explanation at all.
The falling out has been fairly clear. Steve Borthwick wanted Mercer to play in a particular way, and Mercer said, "I'm not that player. If you want somebody just to ram it up the middle, I'm not him. I've got feet, and I want to play that game." So there's the falling out. If
That
there,
makes sense. Makes complete sense.
but look, I mean, I what I see is I see an England pack with a 36-year-old tight end. Now, Dan Cole has, he did he did extremely well in the World Cup. He is still probably, I pitched Collier, who's now going to Castra, so they've obviously, old Sholly's obviously seen something in Collier that the England setup hasn't seen.
A right hook.
Maybe, but I mean, I look at it and I think, England go into a game against Ireland with a bloke who, you know, Dan can, you know, can play 50 minutes, 60 minutes, but when he goes off, you know, I don't think that England have got a test backup. And I also think he's going to have a tough afternoon because Andrew Porter is playing extremely well. He's going up to people. And, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, you can exaggerate the importance of the scrum sometimes. But if it's a wet day, it could become a really
important factor. Yeah.
You know, so I look at it. I mean, Joe Marler is one of England's sort of, and I wouldn't say he's an unsung hero, but he's a very, very good loose head. But it, you know, we're just thin in lots of positions. I don't think Ollie Chessam has played his best rugby over the Six
Nations. No, I don't think he has either.
No, he's down in Notcham a year ago.
So I
agree with that.
I would definitely bring Martin in just because of his you know, his dog really in some ways. But you know, I advocated in that team picking Barbieri at eight because. Mm-hmm. I just think you've got to take it to Ireland in some way, shape, or form. You've got to take it to Ireland, and England's carrying game, you know, disappeared almost against Scotland. So I think England have got, you know, that pack has to do what it did against South Africa. It has to play out of its skin one way or the other. And I wouldn't want on a wet day not to go into a game against Ireland without. A bloke like with the aerial ability of Stewart.
Yeah. Which goes back to Peter Winterbottom's point, doesn't it? A couple of weeks ago on this podcast when he said, look, don't tell the public you're going to play like the Harlem Globetrotters and then have no intention of doing anything of the sort.
No. And incidentally, you know, again, if they're going to play a kicking game, then the idea that Faye Wiboso is just going to be in that starting lineup. I think, you know, Elliot Daly probably stands a fair chance of being in.
Well, I mean, I did wonder. Do you remember last year when we were calling for Henry Arundel to come in for the entirety of the tournament? He finally came in against Ireland and then didn't touch the ball.
Yeah,
this could be exactly the same thing where, you know, he had a try scoring cameo as Arundel did last year, comes in, and then obviously England resort to route one or plan A or plan England rather, and then Faye Wiboso is anonymous and gets dropped again.
And it also goes back to Alex Mitchell, doesn't it, as well? You're asking Alex, you're picking Alex Mitchell on the strength of some really exciting rugby he's played in a really exciting Northampton backline and stick him in a side that is the polar opposite of Northampton. So that goes back to Johnny's point of units and familiarity and the smoothness to your game that gives. Does that make sense, Johnny?
Yeah, no, it does. It all comes back to the way you want to play the game, doesn't it? I've read a lot in the papers around just the inconsistency in selections and changing things. And, you know, we're kind of all talking about changes here and changes there. And then, you know, last week we're going, there's too many changes, so it's kind of we can't win. So it's, you know, I think they are going to play a particular way, and I think that, for instance, I don't see Furbank starting because I don't think he will fit the way that they're going to play this weekend. Could be wrong. I think they're going to be attritional. I think their front row. Well, it'll be interesting to see what they do pick in the front row because they want guys. They want guys who are mobile enough, physical in the tackle, so that, you know, they're going to need guys who move around well, who move around the park well from that perspective. But they don't need ball players in their type five, if you're asking me, because I think that's not what they're looking for. It's not the way that England play at the moment. Ollie Chessam has been a little bit under par, so yeah, George Martin could be a perfect fit for Steve to bring in because he's worked with him at Leicester. He knows him well. He knows what he gets, and he brings that. Well, that dog, as you've already talked about. So depends what way you want to play the game. That's what I reckon he will pick around this weekend.
As a professional coach, Johnny, and we touched on selection earlier. I mean, one of the teams I really admire in all the sport is the Aussie cricket team. They don't change. I mean, I know cricket's not rugby. There are far more injuries in rugby, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's apples and pears, I get. But it is still a part of the Australian mindset in what is still their most important game in terms of internationally speaking. They don't change their team, irrespective of the conditions, irrespective of whether they're home or away, whether it's a Turner or a Greentop. They don't change it. These are our best players.
Yeah.
We expect them to adapt to every circumstance. And what's more, we know they're good enough to adapt to every circumstance. And when you're no longer adapting, that's when we'll make the change. But we don't make the change for the sake of it.
So quality of selection is what you're talking about.
Right.
Selectors, the right people selected at the right time. And that is something which you got to put a very, very big question mark over England rugby at the moment.
It's successive coaches. I mean, going back a long way.
Successive coaches is right.
Going back a long way, almost going back to Woodward.
I'm going to stretch that far, but.
No, I mean, but that England side that won the World Cup had a huge degree of familiarity about it.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah. I think this weekend's selection, I would almost venture to say, is one of, if not the most telling of Borthwick's era.
Yeah, it's the litmus test as how serious he is about the brave talk.
His World Cup, he was never going to push the boat out with a World Cup, whereas this is his first crunch game where it's sort of almost make or break for England Six Nations. Like we say, that 3 out of 5 number is the key number. And to have a
You're
success.
heaping pressure on me, old mate. Goodness me, leave the man alone.
I think, Ollie, no. I think that the time that he needed to make the big change, if he was going to make it, was at the start of this Six Nations with the game against Italy. And then to continue against Wales and against Scotland. And that hasn't happened. You know, they have not played the game that they talked. So now we go back to a huge game, massive pressure against Ireland, and it's not the game probably to experiment in. The experimenting should have been done earlier. You know, the
Have we
change.
made you feel even better about your chances, Johnny?
It's fascinating. In all of this, I can still see England causing Ireland lots of trouble. I genuinely can. I think you're talking about, obviously, as we've gone over the way England want to play the game, and that's obviously Steve and his coaches know exactly what they want and how they want to play the game. I just personally, from watching them, when England are at their best, it's not they don't play rugby from all over the park and don't throw the ball around loads. They will be set piece, there will be attrition, they'll kick well, and then they will take counter-attacking opportunities with dangerous back three players. I think that's been the way through the Eddie Jones. You can argue whether against Eddie, but that's been the way it's been with Eddie, and that got them to a World Cup final. They obviously transitioned with some new players in, but I still think that that is their DNA. That is the way that, and I can't speak for Steve, but I think that's ultimately the way he wants to play. And it's
And
about nailing down the selection that backs that up and filtering guys in around that.
he worked alongside Eddie for 7 years. You know, so I think that you're right. You know, that's what he will be trying to head towards.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that would be my that would be. I mean, as I say, not for 1 minute trying to speak in Steve's behalf, because but he. I have no doubt he will know the way he wants to play the game, and there's obviously lots of pressures from different things, or like from players, from the environment around. Everyone's just trying to play, but you've got to be. I suppose he'll know exactly what he wants to do, and it's about him. It's about him, putting it in the selection at the weekend, and then giving the guys confidence to go out and deliver that plan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Selection dependent, but Danny Kerr is almost unbelievably at this point set to win his 100th cap, having made
Like the
it
podcast,
in. Say again.
bit like the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. We should get him on. I hadn't made that parallel actually, but Danny Kerr is joining the Rugby Paper podcast. I'm sure the Rugby Paper podcast will get a shout out at Twickenham as well on Saturday. But he's winning his 100th cap. It's a day that he probably never thought he'd see, you know, especially in the last 5 years or so. Debut in 2008. First of all, he's the sixth player to win 100 caps for England. Just a bit of on-the-spot trivia. Can anyone name the other five?
Well, we'll have
Jason Cole. That's one. Nice, lads.
Ben Youngs.
Jason Leonard, I didn't hear you say him. Three.
Yeah. Two more.
Yeah, both of them were this year. Both of them happened in 2023, I think.
We had Dan Cole.
You get to my age, short-term memory loss is quite common.
That's a pretty poor effort, guys, if we're tapping out there. Owen Farrell, Courtney Laws.
Yeah, well done.
And all without the aid of Google. Well done.
No Google whatsoever, I promise. Hand on heart. Anyway, anyone have a little...
You're glad you hung on for this, Johnny.
Inspiring.
Thanks, Chris. Again, this thin ice, Chris. But yeah, anyone have anything to say about Danny Kerr? Obviously, it's a very Danny Kerr way to get his 100th cap, in the sort of way his England career has gone up and down and up and down.
Well, he's the great survivor, isn't he? I don't know how many of those caps were starts, but I don't think I've ever known anybody who starts and goes on replacements bench so often. I mean, he just... I don't know what his longest run as the starting nine would be, but, you know, what a valuable player. I mean, what a very valuable player. And at his best, and we talk about units here again, the thing is, we haven't seen much of him with Marcus Smith, have we, for England? And we haven't seen Alex Mitchell with Finn Smith. You know, he definitely brings the best out of Marcus Smith. There's no doubt about that. I first really noticed him 2006 Commonwealth Games sevens. He was a brilliant sevens player. He had everything. He really was good. So, you know, 100 caps for England is terrific. But like you say, it's a slightly odd career. And he's still going strong. I think he still wants another year with Queens, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I just think he's a feel-good player. I would imagine he's terrific in the squad environment. An energy giver as Woodward used to bang on about it. I mean, he just seems to be a really, really good bloke, bright, chirpy, resilient, willing to take on new things, willing to sit on the bench forever and a day if that's what it takes. He just smacks of a bloke who loves the fact that he's still playing rugby when perhaps he didn't expect to be doing it this stage of his career. He's just an optimistic rugby player to me, and you have to like the bloke, actually, and no little skill, obviously, because you don't get to do all those things if you're rubbish. He's a very inventive player. Terrific. I'm really pleased for him. Really pleased for him.
I accept all of that. I think he's a very engaging guy. I think he is an energy giver. And I also think he's been a very, very fine scrum half. But I one man's ceiling is another man's floor. You know, you look at Ben Spencer and, you know, you sort of think, well, you know, Danny Kerr, 100th cap, everybody would like to see him achieve that landmark and so on and so forth. But this is a professional sport. And I thought he was poor against Scotland. I thought Kerr was poor against Scotland. And I thought Ford was poor against Scotland. You had almost 200 caps there. So, you know, selection's got to mean something. And for me, the people who should be selected against Ireland to give England the best chance of winning on the basis of what we've seen are Mitchell and Spencer.
Well, should he be picked, it will probably be, you know, Mitchell will start most likely. It will be off the bench. And even then, Kerr coming off the pitch, say England are under the pump, or Kerr coming off the bench, sorry, may give the Twickenham crowd a bit of a lift. So it'll be a great moment anyway. And huge congratulations to Danny. Like we say, a slightly unconventional way to 100 caps. But
the only thing that will give the Twickenham crowd a lift will be a Tory victory at the general election.
Right. Okay. Scratch him now.
Yeah. Seriously, Chris. I know it's the 100th episode, Chris. Good goodness me. Feels like 150 after this podcast. Right, France, Wales, and Italy, Scotland. Let's just scan through the predictions because I know we've overrun time wise, and I don't want to keep expose Johnny to Chris's jokes for too much longer anyway. Johnny, you've got France by two. Now, coincidentally, well, not coincidentally, but you submit your predictions the week of. We submitted our predictions at the start of the championships. And Nick and Brendan, who will bring up the rear in our predictions league, they've got France by 20.
Sorry, so, who's top again?
Shut up, Chris. Johnny, you've got France by two. Obviously, you think it's going to be close, but is there refereeing controversy again in that France win?
Well, obviously, they're going to be missing Dante. I don't think there's refereeing controversy. I think I'm just giving France the benefit of the doubt, I suppose. I just think they, when they get it right, they can be an awesome team. I think a lot of credit goes to Wales. I think Wales have been, they are a team that would be perceived in huge transition at the moment. But they look very comfortable without the ball. They've just got to get the other aspects right. But I think playing against a French team that are not quite there, missing Dupont, missing Ntamack, lacking a bit of confidence, I think they could run the course. But I just believe France just have the firepower in attack to hurt Wales when they need to.
Do we agree with that, guys? Is anyone, I know you're not allowed to go back on your predictions, but would anyone go back on their France win prediction?
I shall be arguing on Sunday that irrespective of what happens to Wales over the next two games, and they could end up with a wooden spoon, but they could. I think they come out ahead of the game from the side on paper at the start of this tournament. Said this before, it was the weakest side or the least recognisable Wales side I can remember. Extraordinarily callow. Extraordinary. And I think they've over-delivered. In the three games thus far, I think they've over-delivered. And that's credit to them. I think they've been terrific.
It's very bizarre, isn't it? Because like you say, they're not currently bottom in the table somehow, despite that draw, Italy. And Brendan, I know you wrote about this.
That doesn't seem right, but we'll move on.
But three losses and they are bottom, but it would be the most successful wooden spoon that's ever happened, you would argue.
That Warren would be in any way thinking that Wales have been terrific. They may have found some players, but you know, they're three games down, and if they lose their next two, I don't see it as being a great plus for them at all.
They could have lost the first three by 40, and no one would have batted an eyelid with the side they put out.
I don't know,
and they get within a point of Scotland. They should have beaten England. Fair enough, they were not in a position to beat Ireland. That's for sure.
Scotland had them during the World Cup. And they had, you know,
massively. That side has changed massively.
Yeah, it's changed, but it's not changed that massively. He knew who was coming up.
Oh.
You know, I'm not joining the bandwagon, Chris.
Well, no, you, well, you,
especially never, not yours.
You never join any bandwagon I'm on, Nick. That's for sure. But I confidently expect you to see you at the Labour Party meetings in the election campaign.
No, I think that the discourse will change if they lose to Italy, to be fair. And I think that's obviously the biggest game at the other end of the table of the Six Nations.
Yeah, as it was for them last season, actually.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the season before. But yeah, so we've all got a France win, Johnny by two, the rest of us by 10 to 20. And then Italy, Scotland, Brendan, you've backed Italy to win since the start of the tournament. Is this their week carrying the momentum from Leeds?
Well, you kind of feel that things are lining up for them, don't you? I thought they were very good against France, very unlucky in my opinion. And really, they've only had one really poor match, and that was Ireland away. And in fact, you know, Ireland will put 30 points on anybody these days if they're in the mood. So I didn't think that was a complete disaster. So yeah, this is the match for, in fact, the two matches together, this is their season now. If they could get one more win, or let alone get two wins, that would be a really good season, considering where they came from after those two horrendous World Cup performances. So Listen, Scotland are a decent, very decent side, and they know that Italy always get up for playing Scotland. So I'm not confident, but it wouldn't be the strangest thing. And just before we move on from that, just to mention two guys from Italy who've had to retire in the last 10 days, Jake Peledri and Matteo Menozzi. Now, in the really bad old days of Italy, about 5 or 6 years ago, those two were well, Menozzi 6 or 7 years ago was a giant in an absolutely miserably poor Italy team. I think he scored a try in every match won Six Nations and was damn well nearly the player of the tournament in a side shipping 50 points a match. I thought he was a terrific player. Jake Peledri was just on the verge of greatness in 2019. The stuff he was doing at the World Cup 2019 in that season, and such a shame that both have had to give second best to bloody ACL injuries, I think it is, both of them. So just a real shame. You know, Italy have not got that player base that they can just easily lose players like that. So I don't know, a hat tip to both of those. I thoroughly enjoyed watching both of those guys.
Yeah, no, I was just saying about Jake. He just having coached him at Gloucester, just when he came out of Hartbury, he was just this phenomenal freak of an athlete who just was shrugging off like 120 kg players, you know, who looked as if they had him, and he was just leg driving through tackles. I can still see him run up the middle of Kingsholm. So yeah, it was very, very, you know, it was very sad what happened to him in his with his injury. And great guy, and I just wish him a huge amount of luck and success in anything he goes into now.
I think his injury layoff was 677 days, or internationally it was anyway. And I think he had total paralysis in his foot. So to even get to where he got to was
Yeah.
pretty phenomenal. And yeah, very, very sad. I think he's 28. So very, very sad that he's obviously made the right decision to prioritize his own health. But yeah, I think
And
he.
a player that, talking of great selections and signings and what have you, a player that Bristol missed. How did they miss him? His dad was captain of the club for God knows how long.
Gloucester's, you know, recruitment was just superb at that stage.
Well, there was a bloke up there called Bell who knew his stuff, I'm told. I'm just reading this on Google. No, he was a terrific player, Jake. I mean, he looked really equipped to go onwards and upwards, didn't he? Absolutely terrific.
And such a shame as well, because a back row with Negri, Lamoureux, and Prime Peledri right now would be very, very formidable. And that's no disrespect to Lorenzo Cannone, who's a very good player as well. But yeah, that would be something to contend with.
I'm not sure it's really, well, it wouldn't be within the rules, but he could have been a lion, couldn't he? Except he played for the wrong country. But look, I mean, he's a Bristol boy.
He had that ability. He was, you know, he certainly both sides of the ball. I mean, he was tremendous in attack, ability to break tackles and make runs and offload, and then his ability over the ball as well defensively was second to none. So yeah, and he was not that one. Was, you know, he should be now just in the prime of his career, really pushing on. So yeah, it's very
He
sad.
wasn't like he wasn't unlike the aforementioned Stephen Ferris, actually,
Very similar, yeah.
who also had to retire horribly early.
That's right. Yeah, no, I try, very, very similar in their styles of play. Abrasive, you know, he liked the physical side of the game, but incredibly dynamic. Both players very dynamic, and powerful. Yeah, just great athletes, and yeah, it's missed.
No, 100%. Well, let's hope again that, like Stephen, who has enjoyed found something he really enjoys in retirement, that Jake finds exactly the same. So we do wish him all the best. Johnny, we're going to take a trip down Rugby Paper Podcast memory lane, which I won't make you sit through because God knows what Dewey's going to come out with. But where will you be
Pre party
watching?
meeting you're having now, is that
Where will you be watching on Saturday?
I'm actually doing a wee bit of BBC radio stuff, so I'll be
Oh.
from the studio. Yeah, I'm looking forward. I'm really genuinely, it's there's probably two games. The Italy Scotland game I find fascinating because it's been they've been Scotland's bogey team, haven't they? So and then obviously the England game, I just can't wait to see how Ireland deal with England's tactics. I'm interested.
It's a weekend that it's very difficult to predict the script of, actually. So it'll be very interesting to see how it goes. But yeah, I thank you for joining us. I realize we sort of overextended slightly, but we really appreciate the time you gave us and the extra time as well. And on behalf of Chris Hewitt, I apologize too.
No, look, guys, thank you very much for having me on. And I wish you all the best. And hopefully, I can do it again sometime. But thanks very much. Cheers, Johnny.
Thanks, Johnny. Very kind. Thank you. Take care.
Take care, Johnny. Right. Well, we've been going nearly an hour and a half. So, out of the 100 episodes we've done, this will be, barring David Campese, obviously, this will definitely be one of the longer ones. Yeah, just a bit, I thought it would be good to commemorate 100 episodes in some form. I only clocked it looking opening my Google Doc because I always write the number of the episode rather than each season. But season one was 46 episodes, season two, 27, and then this is 26 and counting. So I don't know, Nick and Brennan, you've been there from the very start. Chewy, I think you were a slightly late addition, maybe a couple of months after the podcast started. But when
I think it's when you thought you needed some intellectual ballast.
Yeah, exactly. And we're still looking for that, to be honest.
There's a bloke next door who's a Manchester United supporter. He might he might make more sense than me.
There's another bloke called Manu Tuilagi who's on the other side.
Oh yeah, Manu.
What's the word I hear?
Yeah, but if it, I mean, if, look, if Manu comes after me, I can always run away safe in the knowledge that I like pacing.
I don't think you will, Chris. I think even Manu, you won't outpace. But yeah, Brendan and Nick, well.
Even Manu.
I'm just going down your line
that's
of
a
thinking.
shocker. I'd be furious if I was him.
I'm not too worried that he's going to be listening personally. Nick, Brendan, did you guys think we'd make it 100 episodes in?
Oh, very dubious. I thought we might just get to the end of the season and the rugby paper would pull the plug, but they know when they're onto a good thing, don't they? I mean, let's face it. And that's been good fun, hasn't it? I mean, you don't often get a chance to shoot the breeze so consistently for an hour and a half every week with people who sort of vaguely know what they're talking about. So, and the quality of guests have been good.
The back ender.
The quality of guests has been very good. They all have something to say and well played for roping them in on it. It's a bit of a stretch sometimes, but they do add to it a lot, and it's good to hear other people's opinions, that they say things that you don't think about sometimes because they come from a completely different angle, don't they, from a journalist
But
when they're actually involved at the grassroots or at the sharp end. You just get a different perspective, and it's important to sort of keep these guys and girls coming in.
absolutely. I mean, what's clear about it is the enthusiasm of the people who come onto the podcast. I mean, by and large, they inform from all sorts of different perspectives and angles, and that makes it fascinating. And I mean, I think we've had some great guests, and just their willingness to join us and to look at this multifaceted game, which is very often great and very often very frustrating, and so on. I think it's certainly been something that I've enjoyed a great deal and has informed me,
Oh, 100% likewise. And I'd like to think that as a podcast, we also find a slightly different way of going about rugby. I mean, last week's episode with Thomas Appleton, I think, was a great example, giving Portugal some much needed coverage, or James Waterhouse a year ago was a great example, just blending the very different aspects of, well, one, intra rugby, but also outside rugby. Appleton's a medicine student, captaining his nation. James Waterhouse is an ex-rugby player who's obviously currently a journalist at with the BBC in Ukraine. So I think
And
that's
Tom, we had Tom Rees, of course, after
Tom
the
Rees.
COVID experience, Dr. Tom Rees.
Alistair Hicknall was a good one as well.
You're far too young, Ollie, for this to be relevant to you. But what would I think my esteemed colleagues here would agree, we're of a similar journalistic generation, is back in the day, after a game, you would inevitably mix with the players in the bar. King's Home or the Rec or wherever it might be, and you'd have these kinds of conversations over a pint. I mean, this is the nearest thing now, because that side of it's pretty much gone. Everything is much more strictly controlled. It's been totally footballized. Even the journalists don't have the equivalent access to players immediately after a game, just to shoot the breeze, talk about the game on a sort of wide ranging canvas. That doesn't happen now. And this is the nearest equivalent, because this is totally informal. It's totally unscripted, apart from your bit, Ollie. And we can go absolutely, you know, in any direction of the rugby compass and have an interesting conversation. And it has the added benefit of while you're doing it, you're not getting Gareth Chilcott coming up and trying to break your ribs, or, you know, Jack Rowell looking down from a 7 foot height and calling you an intellectual midget. But that aside, it's just a lovely thing to do. And Nick's absolutely right. The enthusiasm of the guests is invariably terrific, and you know, they're prepared to talk quite openly. Sometimes on relatively difficult subjects, they always give a view. There aren't many no comments on this podcast, and that's the glory of it, really.
I can't think of any no comments, really.
No.
Gavin Hastings, obviously, about his own son, but very rarely. So people do come on and speak very frankly, which is great.
Another one that just flashed back, Christian Wade. Wasn't he good when he came on? Wow, that was a fantastic insight into what had been going on in his life and the frustrations with England, and then what it took. Well, Rhys Ammett is now going through it. What it takes to even try and become an NFL player. You know, we'll see how that goes with Rhys Ammett. But Christian couldn't quite crack it. But he gave it a bloody good go.
Yeah, no.
And I have to say that, I mean, I wasn't present for all 100, as you pointed out at the start. I'm a bit of a relative Johnny come lately, but I have to say the great question ever asked any of our guests has to be, Ollie, you ask him, Willie John McBride, what he would have been had he not been a rugby player. To which he said, well, I worked in banking because it was an amateur game.
I mean, you mentioned the
good research. Good research.
No. I mean, you mentioned some of my bits are scripted. The random rugby 15. I'm obviously reading from a hymn sheet. I've definitely had some worse unscripted questions.
Ollie, it was a joke.
No, I know, and a terrible one at that. So no change there.
Listen, just remember that when it comes to all our yesterdays, we failed on the big one, which is naming the 500 England caps just a few minutes ago.
two of whom happened a week last Thursday.
Well, then you said short-term memory is the issue at the moment. Oh, 1980s, I could write a couple of books on.
Yeah. Well, Jason Leonard came to all of your minds pretty quickly. The other four...
But he was the first, wasn't he? I think that's probably why.
Yeah, and it was a massive gap after that, actually.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, it's amazing how far it's come. We got 50 listens or something in the first week of the podcast with that first episode with Jerry Guscott. And now, you know, regularly, 10,000 plus listeners, which... So, you know, a massive thank you for those who continue to follow the podcast, because we couldn't do it without you. And just with that comes a pledge to keep making content for you guys to either enjoy or get riled up about.
Yeah. And for you, Ollie, my editing job on this one.
Yeah. I know. I'll just leave that last sentence in and just ignore the rest of the and Johnny Bell's bits and just ignore the rest of the podcast. I'm gonna ask everyone to pick their, just to finish, their favourite episode from all 100. And I'm going to start, since he's riled me up so much today, with Chewy.
Mark Quato. It all made complete sense.
Right, yeah, but your favourite is the unedited Mark Quato. Unfortunately, it was very filtered by the time it came out.
The edited bit is... In all seriousness, Mark was at his quirkiest, which was fantastic. He was a bloody good player and a good bloke, and he was in a fairly random way, wildly entertaining that day. And I thought, Ollie, and I'm not blowing smoke, I thought that that was very well chaired under the circumstances. I thought it was very good. But actually, I thought one of the most illuminating conversations, and it, this often happens with people who come from the sort of, without being rude, a sort of more a backwoodsy area of the game. I thought the discussion with Appleton, ahead of that big game for them, the Iberian Derby at the weekend, was absolutely terrific. He was the, to me, the absolute essence and epitome of a rugby bloke who sort of basically embodied the rugby spirit, if you like. And because of that discussion, I was quite keen to watch the Iberian Derby, which I did on Sunday. And it was an interesting game, and he played really well. So I was delighted with that addition, because I thought it was genuinely interesting, and it touched on a lot of important subjects for the game going forward.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Yeah, and also, well, I mean, he seemed like the perfect human being, Thomas Appleton, as well. Absolutely
Very
lovely.
few of us left.
That's your first good one, Chris, in an hour and a half.
It's a tough crowd.
People
That tickled
are laughing.
me.
That
Are they laughing with me or at me, Nick?
that was very good. Brendan, what's your favorite?
I enjoyed the Tomas one last week very much, and indeed the other Portuguese, Francisco. So,
Brendan, what do you
for the same
think?
reasons, I would still go for the one I'd nominated at the end of last year. That would be James Marshall, and the same. Not James Waterhouse, sorry. And the same reason being, proper rugby bloke with more than one dimension, in fact, multifaceted. Very decent championship player. And then suddenly he's projected into this war situation and he's having to dig deep and he's become their man there, hasn't he? Totally. He just seems to be over there all the time. And I just thought it was a very warm conversation we had with him that time. He was welcoming the conversation as a little bit of light relief from the madness out there. And just interesting, just he's very articulate and came at rugby from another angle, which we don't always think about. So, listen, I love that. There's been loads of really good ones, but they're the ones that instantly flash to mind.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, two that I mean, there's three that stood out. I thought I enjoyed the Willie Anderson one very much, and he ended up being proved right, but for the probably most of the wrong reasons, I think. I really enjoyed Cobus Visser as well. I thought he was a great guest, and obviously the other bloke who is, was a genius of a player, and is always very, his stuff about Eddie Jones not understanding anything about play at all, I thought was priceless. Was Campo, I mean, just insights and very outspoken and very entertaining as well. So yeah.
Yeah, just to mine was going to be the first Campo episode. Just to I've got some quotes written down from that one as well, actually, which I thought we could just relive for a bit of fun. One, I don't give a shit about Wayne Barnes. Two, Eddie Jones has small man syndrome. And three, Owen Farrell should be banned for life. Obviously, we all know him as outspoken, and Campo definitely came in off the long run that day. But that will live long in my memory, however many more episodes of this podcast we have. And I will do my best to get Campo on probably once a year, just to talk at us rather than with us for a couple of hours at a time. But like I say, we pledge to continue making more podcasts, and we really appreciate you following us at home. So thanks very much. And guys, enjoy the weekend, and I'll see you next week.
Well played, Ollie.
Take care. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Rugby Paper Podcast. And don't forget to subscribe on whichever podcast platform you use and recommend the show to your friends.
The Rugby Paper is available to buy every Sunday, and to make sure you don't miss it, subscribe through our print, digital and online options at therugbypaper.co.uk/subscriptions. That's therugbypaper.co.uk/subscriptions to get all our content for as little as 14p per day.